Hi everyone, welcome back to the Change Your Mind podcast, where we explore personal development, spirituality, and science. I'm your host, Chris Ashley, and I'm really excited for today's episode. I have with me a high performance coach, but first, before I introduce him, a couple quick announcements. Head over to the links in the bios. You are going to find a lot there. You're going to find links to my book, to both of my television shows, to all my speaking engagements, as well as how to connect with me on social media. You'll also find ways to connect with my amazing guest and ways to sponsor the podcast and work with me on a coaching in my coaching classes. So there's lots there if you want to keep the conversation and the learning going. And as always, this podcast is part of the Los Angeles Tribune Podcast Network. We are doing phenomenal things in personal development. We have events pretty much every month. I was just on stage with Les Brown and Dr. Joe Vitale and Joseph McClendon and Dean Graziosi, and we're having so much fun. Come be a part of it. The summits we're doing are amazing. What if the one thing keeping you stuck is the way you think? Welcome to Change Your Mind with Chris Ashley, the podcast where science meets spirituality and mindset becomes your most powerful tool for transformation. I'm Chris Ashley, author of Change Your Mind to Change Your Reality, trainer, speaker, and lifelong seeker. For years, I battled trauma, depression, anger, chronic illness, low self-worth, and the weight of old stories. Until I discovered how to rewire my mind, reconnect with my divine nature, and consciously create a new reality from the inside out. This show is here to help you do the same. Each week, we explore the intersection of personal development, spirituality, and science. Diving into topics like healing, emotional mastery, entrepreneurship, resilience, and the quantum nature of reality. You'll hear powerful stories, gain practical tools, and real conversations that will help you change your perspective, get unshakable confidence, and live the vision your soul has always known is possible. Whether you're navigating a major life shift, building your dream business, or seeking deep healing and alignment, you're in the right place. So if you're ready to break through, take back your power, and create a life on your terms, this is your moment. Let's break free from the patterns that hold us back, awaken to who we truly are, and rise. Your transformation starts now. All right, so with me today, I have Gary Chupik. So Gary is internationally recognized as one of the top mental performance coaches in the world. Gary unlocks performance in professional teams, athletes, business professionals, and those wanting to find the next level in their performance. Gary's unique methods and processes are unprecedented in the sports and business worlds. He's an international speaker, writer, and a member of many associations. So welcome, Gary. I'm so glad you're here with me.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Chris.
Absolutely. You know, I always start my shows off the same way, and that's by asking my guests, what is their origin story? So I'd love for you to just kind of walk me through it. How did you become one of the top mindset coaches in the world, which is like a pretty bold statement, right? So I'd love to hear your journey.
Yeah, that might be slightly overstated. I've been called that multiple times just by some friends and that kind of thing. But I think
hey,
it was,
own it.
Well, I think that thinking was infused into me at a really young age. I was probably 13 or 14 years old. And I had one of the leaders in my life say, Gary, you have greatness in you. And I never comprehended what that meant. But there were four letters that I think are maybe the most important four letters in the alphabet that a leader can tell someone that's a follower. And that is, I see in you. I see in you. And here's what I see in you. And that's what that was infused in me at a really young age. And I think I just was always searching for that. Like, well, what does someone else see in me that might even resemble greatness? And I'm not sure I ever noticed what that was until maybe even the last few years. So it's been a really fun journey. I ended up going to different and multiple theological schools. So I actually have an MDiv, a Master of Divinity, and I was an ordained pastor for over 30 years. And so spirituality has always been important to me. And in the work that I do now, it certainly informs me, because I do think that we are four parts: body, mind, soul, and spirit. And so I very much view us as quadratic beings. And I think to tap into each one of those things makes I think, for a recipe for success, no matter what it is that we do. So yeah, growing up in the ministry and always being in the ministry, thinking like I was in the ministry, I think has always been valuable to me. However, I never ever wanted to work inside the four walls of the church, but I found myself there for over 30 years. So I was kind of like a reluctant leader and felt very confined by the four walls of the church. And I'd done a lot of chaplaincy at Veterans Hospital here in Seattle and with different sports teams. So chaplaincy, I think, was really a lot of fun for me because it expanded my view of spirituality. And so what I do today is maybe the best word is recruit. I like to recruit the different parts of the human being for human performance and just to see how far we can push ourselves and what we can become and what we can do.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I didn't know that you had that background. You said you were kind of reluctant. Like, what made you decide to be a pastor?
Well, you know, that's an interesting story. I think a lot of us are put in classes in life that we didn't ask for. Or maybe there's a degree maybe that we wanted, but we don't get to choose all the classes that we are in. And so I think I was placed in lots of situations where it just seemed like the right next step was to say yes to different opportunities. And so I cultivated this sort of this yes, God view of my life. And so whatever was put in front of me, I just kind of said yes to. And so I think a lot of my years growing up was about being a sponge. And it was just about learning as whatever I could possibly learn in the moment. And I put the onus back on God. In other words, if you don't want me to pursue certain opportunities that are in front of me, then you should either not give them to me or somehow make it evident that that wasn't the case. And so I've kind of lived my life this way. It's like always a yes, unless it's a no.
Yeah, one of my mentors would always say yes, unless there's a really good reason to say no. And I've kind of lived my life like that too. So did you grow up in the church and like someone kind of pulled you into it, or what did that look like?
Yeah, I grew up in a Christian home and grew up in a really is one of the flagship churches of our denomination in Canada. And by the way, I get to speak there next, you know, in a couple Sundays from now. I'm pretty excited about that. It's quite an honor to do that. But yeah, I grew up in that. But I was always a skeptic. I think the word skeptic I heard recently means to look from afar. And I've always sort of been, you know, I don't know, I've always been a skeptic, even in my own faith and even in my own religion. I just always have been skeptical of like, how do other people view this? And is this really, are there different perspectives that I'm not aware of? And I think that chaplaincy scratched that itch, was to explore different religions and different spiritualities. And even though I've landed on Christianity, I certainly have a respect for people who have, you know, view life differently or have different faiths or whatever the case is. I just really respect them all as a search for God, search for meaning, search for purpose. And I can certainly respect that everyone has that no matter where they've grown up or what they've done.
Yeah. It's, what is it? Like many paths, one truth at the end of the day. So talk to me about the chaplaincy. Was that, you said it was in a VA hospital, right? Like, when I think like hospital chaplain, I think like bedside when people are dying or like seriously injured, comforting families. Like, is that kind of what it looked like, or did it look like something different?
Yeah, no, it was a lot of that. I worked on critical care and spinal cord injury. No one wakes up in the morning thinking that they're going to not ever walk again. And so it was a joy and an honor to walk with people through that. And so that's a lot of my history is death, dying, suffering, you know, just trying to make sense of all those things and make sense of death and life. And so I've had a lot of exposure, even in my own personal life, with death and suffering. That's been sort of a normal part of my life. And then to make things interesting, I was the chaplain for the Seattle Thunderbirds, the hockey team here in Seattle for 7 years. So I've had a different, whatever the venue has been, it's always been a challenge for me to try and help people connect with God and connect with whatever they felt like was their higher power. And I just viewed myself as someone who would come alongside of people and help. And what I do now with coaching, it's actually not been that different. It's helping people make sense of their lives, how to be at their very best, how to process things by asking really important questions.
Yeah, totally. I can see how that'd be a really easy bridge. I didn't know sports teams had chaplains. That's really interesting. I have to ask, did you ever have any mystical experiences around people dying?
Yeah, I've had multiple. Yeah, there's just so much around that. There's so much to talk about when it comes to people dying and some of the things that they process in their last moments. I mean, to be able to be with, I mean, holding people who have been dying has been common for me, mm-hmm. and those that I've loved, and even in the chaplaincy work at Veterans Hospital. And I mean, probably nothing metaphysical that people might consider or think about, but many real life, real moment, times and experiences where people are just, I think, just really thinking about who they love and what they love in those last moments and what was really valuable to them. And that's been, it's been certainly an education or a classroom that I really learned a lot with. And so even for me in my life now, I'm 57, I just turned 57. And I'm always thinking about like my next 10. That's kind of one of the phrases I've been thinking about a lot lately is, and helping leaders actually think that through is like, what do you want the next 10 years of your life to look at in view of the whole totality of your life or your legacy? And yeah, that's a really interesting question, really interesting mm-hmm. topic, and really thinking deeply about this, because I think there's two ways of wanting. There is what you want and what you really want. Now, I don't know about you, but what I want might be the pizza and to watch football all day on a Friday or a Saturday. But what I really want is to have a generational impact in people's lives. And so what I think ends up happening is many of us end up spending the vast majority of our time really chasing after what we want instead of what we really want. Mm-hmm. And so I decided that what if I was to like flip that around and spend 80% of my time chasing what I really want and maybe 10 or 20% chasing after what I think I might want. And that differentiation has been really valuable for me, because now I can isolate and focus my energy and time on the things that really matter to me and the things that I really want.
Yeah, I love that. It makes me think, like, there's that Tony Robbins quote where he's like, people, hopefully I won't butcher it, like, people overestimate what they can get done in a year and underestimate what they can get done in 5 years. But 10 years is a really long stretch. Do you find that when you're coaching people through that, like, I'm trying to like formulate how I'm trying to like get this out. I guess, like, do people overestimate or underestimate what they can get done in 10 years? Does that make sense? Well,
yeah, it depends on their age. So I had the privilege. Yeah, I had the privilege of working on a yacht recently, and there were, I mean, 10 global businessmen, and they were thinking about, you know, they were thinking about 10 year periods. Mm-hmm. You know, where do they want to be 10 years from? I think when you're younger, 10 years is a long time. Like, even 5 years is a stretch. I remember when I used to do strategic planning for businesses and nonprofits, we would have a 20-year vision and a 10-year vision. And now the longest vision anybody ever puts together is 5 years. So typically, I'd like to do a one-year vision and a 3 or 4 or 5. So a 3 to 5 year vision. Having yeah. both of those is pretty valuable, but a 10-year, I think, is really valuable for people in their 50s and 60s, because they do kind of feel like, okay, what do I want to accomplish in these last few years of my life? And it's interesting. I had a gal who was 61 years old, and she had experienced the death of her husband while he was sleeping at night. He was a business owner. They were business owners, but he just died in his sleep. You know, he was probably in his early 60s as well. And this lady said to me, what do I do with the rest of my life? I have resources, I have time, I have money, and I want to think in terms of the next 10 years of my life. What do I want to do? And so I have something called the game plan for life. And so we talk about, like, what do you want to see happen in the final decade of your life based on your identity? So it's identity-based planning or strategic planning for somebody's life. So that's what the game plan for life is. And so she really believed that she really wanted to travel the world and help the less fortunate. And so it was really fun. In fact, it's been so delightful to see her live out her game plan for life in the last decade. And so I think it's been probably 6 or 7 years, and it's fun to see all the pictures on social media of all of the philanthropic work that she's doing. So it's super exciting.
Yeah, that's cool. That makes a lot more sense, because I'm 40. And when I think, like, I'm like, wow, so much can change in a decade. like so much can change, right? So much can change in a year or 6 months, right? But if we're talking about like legacy and, you know, those final working years, someone said to me recently that there's three phases you go through in life. It's learning, earning, and returning. And that's really stuck with me. So I can see how someone in those final years is like, okay, I've done this. I'm like ready to give back, or I'm ready to like, you know, finish this for my kids and hand it off, or, you know, that makes a little more sense. Cause
yeah, the game plan for life really,
what's it called? Is it gay plan or gate plan?
The game plan.
Game plan. Okay.
Yeah, the game plan for life.
That makes more sense. I was like, I couldn't quite understand. Okay.
Yeah. The game plan for, it really serves two purposes. Number one, it serves for anyone who wants to optimize, like life optimization, like how do I do this right? How do I not waste time? How do I make sure I'm doing the right things at the right time? Like that piece. And then for, there are those that want to figure out what their next steps are. And so that could be the, like the game plan for life. Well, I mean, you can use it on a quarterly, or even actually it goes even finer than that, or more, more zoomed in than that. You could do it. You can use the game plan for life on a daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly, annual, and then pick a 3, 4, or 5 year. And I think it just works for all of those. But the special thing about the game plan for life is it's not based on ambition. It's based on your identity. So I have ambition to do all sorts of things. Like, are you kidding me? Like the world is my clam. Like I could go do all sorts of things, and I would love to, yeah. But the things that I'm most likely to be successful at are the things that identify who I am, like they're identity based. So when a plan is identity based and it's customizable, you can do that all day long. And I think to be successful at anything requires us to have consistency. So if we're not consistent, we're probably not going to succeed at something. But if it's an identity based game plan, you have a real good shot at doing that because nobody knows you better than you.
Talk to me a little more about what you mean by identity based, because that's really interesting.
Yeah. So for example, in terms of leadership, you have, I mean, imagine wearing a pair of glasses and you have a lens on the left eye and a lens on the right eye, and one of them is fit. So that's the name of that lens, is fit, and another one is passion. So when it comes to your passions or the things that you might feel ambitious about, well, those things are wonderful, but that ambition or that passion can waver, it can change, it can ebb and flow. But when you do things according to the fit or your identity or your personality, that actually has enough longevity to be able to be really great at something. So doing things that are a better fit for you in terms of your personality and identity are actually more advantageous than doing things based on passion and ambition.
So just to make sure I'm like understanding correctly, is it like if someone has, you know, strong leadership skills, like the fit would be like in a leadership role of some kind? Is that kind of what you mean?
Kind of. You know, for example, like one of the exercises in the game plan for life is what I call a self-scouting report. So it's you just sort of having a moment in the process for you to sort of put down on paper 7 or 8 different kinds of traits that you have. So for example, what are your passions? What are things that are needs? What are desires? What are things that you're good at? What are some of your achievements? And it kind of takes the totality of all of those. Actually, there's 9 different categories. And once we put them all down on paper, we do a little bit of a, I don't know, I like to call it an out-of-body experience. Like they're the ones giving me the words, I'm writing them down. And if you didn't know the person that this piece of paper is describing, what if we just looked at that piece of paper and that was all the evidence that we had? And we just circled the words that all reflected your talent and ability in one color. And then in another color, we would identify the things that have to do with your heart. So your purpose, your calling, your vision, and your strategy. Mm-hmm. And if we could figure out the cross-section, just like if you're looking through, let's say, you know, the sights of a gun, let's say, and we were to target or pinpoint those two lines, well, what would happen in the middle is we would find what are a mix of your talent and your ability and your passions, which include your calling, your purpose, your vision, and your strategy. Because your purpose is why, it answers the question, why am I here? And your calling answers the question, what should I do with my life? So when you can combine your head, which is clarity, and your heart, which is your conviction, when you can like recruit those two things and you can like identify the electrical arc between those two things, you have something really electric and wonderful.
Very cool. And then from there, you're able to help people. I mean, like, what's the next step? Like, you're like, okay, we have your fit, right? How do we figure out, or how do you figure out with someone what their next 3 to 5 year plan is based on that?
Yeah. Yeah. It's so much fun. Actually, it's like, it's a 2-day experience and it really is like the best game plan, like life strategy game planning that I've ever experienced in 35 years. It just works so well. I've never had a dud. So what did the beginning or the first stage is identifying who you are. So we have to have a really clear picture of who you are. And it's also interesting to find out who you think you are, because those actually might be different. And so we take a little bit of a deep dive into what your self-perception is. And I like to think of those in terms of archetypes. So you have your identity. So who am I? Then the second phase of the game plan for life is where am I now? Like, what am I experiencing in the present moment? Then the third phase is where am I going? Like, what are my opportunities? What are my options based on my identity and where I presently am? And then the fourth phase is how will I get there? So what are the things what vehicles am I going to ride in order to get to where I want to go? And then the last category or phase is what will I need? So how do you empower yourself with the skills and talents and abilities that I'm going to need in order to accomplish those things? So it is really based on identity. And when you remove your ambition from your identity, then you probably don't really have much of a shot of accomplishing those things because there's not enough of you in it.
So I like that you said it's interesting to see like what people think about themselves versus like how they actually are. So how do you differentiate those two things? Because right before you said that, I was thinking and I was like, well, some people might have might not truly know themselves, right? Like, how do you figure out which is which?
Yeah, a really fun word for that is blind spots. Like what blind spots do we have about ourselves that when other people can reflect back to us what they see, they can be an aha moment for them. I like to think of it as like the pickle jar. You're inside the pickle jar. You can't always see the labels outside of the pickle jar, but you have to have someone else read them to you at times. And so I had one client who, in fact, I actually changed my process because of him. Yeah, I had one client who would always say, well, why do I always get fired from jobs? You know, he's this high level leader. And after a year or two, his pattern is that he gets fired. And so I'm like, well, what is the perception of the people hiring you of you? And what is your self-perception of you going into these situations? And so he thought of himself, he never said this, but he thought himself as a demo guy, that he was going to come in and he was going to be that big wrecking ball because he was getting hired by organizations that needed someone just to, you know, come in and restart. Well, restart is very different than a wrecking ball. And so he was just a wrecking ball for the first 6 months and everybody didn't like him. And then he would start to rebuild, but he never lasted long enough to be, you know, to actually rebuild and be a remodeler. And so I thought to myself, like, what is the perception this person has of himself that is allowing him, that he didn't project very well during the interview, apparently, but what is his self-perception or what's the undercurrent of that's driving his behaviors, his thought process and behaviors? And I just realized there's such a difference between how someone thinks of themselves and how people experience them. And I don't know about you, but sometimes I can be off on my own self-perception. And what I actually think, there's such a difference between perception and perspective. So someone will say, well, this is my perspective on things. And I'm like, no. That's actually your perception of things. And when we all share our perception, then we get perspective. Because sometimes we think that if I share my perspective, that everyone just has to accept it because, well, it's just my perspective. And it's almost inarguable. But in another way, can your perceptions ever be wrong about something? Well, of course they can. And so I think it's important for people to understand that they're just sharing their perception and cannot be off. And so people's perceptions of themselves could be different than people's perspective of them. And so to be able to share that with him and with this particular client was really helpful because I said, well, you know what? Is there a chance that other people could be perceiving you differently than you see yourself. And he was like, yeah, I guess that could be true. And so just to reflect that back to him was like the filling in or the taking off of the veil of the blind spot, which was really helpful for him.
Yeah, that's a great story. So do you find that like when you go through this exercise with people, it kind of cuts through their own perception and like gets down to the core of who they really are? Like, do you ask them who they think they are in the beginning so you can kind of like compare? Or
I do.
How do you, yeah.
Yeah, I most certainly do. So one of the exercises is them identifying their archetypes. So there's hundreds of archetypes. There's the Enneagram or archetypes. You know, in a story, you see a hero or a villain or, you know, whoever it is, right? Or, you know, whoever it is, a joker, a jester is an archetype. And so having them identify their archetypes and how strong those archetypes are in their thinking is really valuable, because it's kind of like the operating system on a computer. You kind of don't really understand or know that you're really using an operating system, but it's always there. Just like your phone has an operating system or the computer has an operating system. And so I have them draw this triangle and I have them put down their top three archetypes and how big each of those sections are in their identity. And that way you can learn a lot about someone really quickly if you understand their own self-perception.
So I'm trying to think about like who, like what I would say for archetypes. Like, where do you even start? Do you give people like a list to go off of? Or okay.
Yeah, I never used to, because it's a little bit, you know, a little bit hazy, a little bit fuzzy. But now I have a list of about 100 archetypes where people can kind of circle the ones that they think they are. Like, for example, you know, like hero or warrior or princess, like, or all these different words. Or, you know, I had one of my clients call herself the mat. She was a chemist. She's a research chemist. And so she called herself the strategic chemist. Like, just beautiful words that would just describe it, how she views life as almost this alchemy of different ideas and thoughts. And it was just beautiful, right? Just super cool. And then to see her work in her industry and come up with innovative things was just, it's just magnificent. So yeah, having a list of things for people to pick is really valuable.
That's cool. I've never heard anyone with a similar, I guess, game plan for life as you have. It's really, I like how you do it. I like how you break it down. As a coach and a human being, how often do you redo yours?
Wow, that's such a great question. Well, initially, I used to say every 5 years was great to do a refresh. But I've had people refresh it and say, hey, can I hire you for a couple hours and can we just refresh this thing? And it's so valuable to do it. There are multiple exercises, and I think it's one of the values of the game plan for life. There's probably 4 or 5 exercises that you can refresh on an annual basis. And so I think that's part of the magic, is that they're reusable tools that you can use in your life and also in your business. Like, I have never seen another tool like it. I think it's the best tool I've ever come across in 35 years of leadership. And you can use it in your own personal life. You can use it in your own marriage. You can use it in your business. I've done it with professional sports teams, and I've done it with moms. It's just, it works.
Well, you got to tell us about it now.
Oh, it works every single time.
All right. Well, what's the tool, Gary?
So the tool is called the Perspectives Tool. So you have 5 different columns or categories. So remember, in the game plan for life, we have the second stage. The first stage is talking about your identity. The second stage is, where are you at now? So let's you know, think about your identity as sort of a little bit of a past, you know, digging for treasures about your past and who you think you are and some of the things that you've gone through in your, because all those identity things are formed typically in your past. So the identity is a big deal, but then you move to the second stage, which is, where am I now? So this is a where am I now tool. So the first column is what's going right in your life. And I like to say it this way: what feels right about everything that you're going through, anything in your life? What just feels right? People are like, you know, what do you mean by feels? Exactly. I want you to just write down what just feels right. So it gives them a lot of permission to say anything they want. But typically what they do is they do communicate the boulders. So there's boulders and pebbles. The pebbles are the small stuff. You're not going to get all the pebbles, but you can get the big stuff. So what are the boulders? So what just feels right in your life? Your marriage, your job, your income, your kids, your family, relationships. I mean, anything, but those top of mind things are usually the boulders. Not always, but usually. Mm-hmm. So what feels right? The second category is what feels wrong, which is typically a little bit longer, not always, but typically longer than the what's right category. So what just feels wrong? Yeah, what do you mean? I don't know, what just feels wrong?
And yeah, so what could be improved? What isn't in alignment?
Yeah, specifically wrong. What just feels like it shouldn't be this way? That's the key phrase or thought.
I like that.
Be this way. So they might talk about their finances or relationship or whatever. The third column is what feels confusing. What just feels confusing to you? And usually this is a fairly long column as well. What just feels confusing? Well, you know, I'm not really sure. I say, well, you know, think about what you think about. Like, what are the repetitive thoughts that are coming to your mind? Because you haven't closed the psychological loop on it.
Yeah.
So what are the things that what feels confusing to you? Then they kind of hem and haw, and then they get there. They'll name multiple things. And then the fourth column is what feels like it's missing. What's missing? And of course, sometimes
questions.
Yeah. Like what? I mean, oftentimes you're like, well, if I knew what was missing, I would fix it, or I would go gain that thing. But sometimes we don't really think about what's missing. And so what's missing from your life? And then the final column I added a few years ago, because it's so helpful for me to understand someone. And that is, what's overwhelming? What just feels overwhelming to you? And that kind of gets at the heart of the matter, because you can talk about what's right, wrong, confusing, missing, but that overwhelming column, it's very informative at this point. And if you notice, it's very important to go in sequence. So you can have all the right ingredients when you bake a cake, but unless you put it in the right order, you will never get the intended outcome. And so to do each of these columns in the right order produces something beautiful. So at the end of it, you have right, wrong, missing or confusing, what's missing, what's overwhelming. And then I do something called clustering. And so what are the common themes that we see here on the paper? And so I'll take anything to do with money, I'll circle those things in green. And anything to do with relationships, I'll circle those things in, let's say, red, and so on and so forth. So you're just kind of clustering themes. And then you end up coming up with two or three themes. And how do you identify which is the most important? So this is called the Hoshin model of interrelationship. What we're trying to do is figure out if they were to solve, they're not going to solve every problem, but if they were to solve, let's say, a money problem or a business problem or a relationship problem or a communication problem, it would actually affect all the rest of the categories.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's the Hoshin model of interrelationship. And then we try and narrow it down by clustering. And then I end up saying something like, does this accurately reflect where you're at? And they're like, oh my gosh, this is such an amazing job. And then I said, well, you know, it looks like if you were to work on this one category, it would have the biggest impact in your life. And they see it because now they're engaging their left brain, they've engaged their right brain, and they look at it and they kind of go, huh. This is like makes things, everything exceedingly clear. And if I was to do this with the Seattle Seahawks or the Oregon Ducks, which I probably will be doing this summer, you know, with I've done it with businesses, I've done it with nonprofits, I've done it with coaches, I've done it. I mean, you name it, I have done it. And it works every single time.
So it's really about getting clear on maybe not like your vision, but about, you know, what steps you need to take or what you need to work on, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
When I think about that, it's like there's so much overlap between, you know, what feels confusing or what feels wrong or what's missing or what's overwhelming. It's kind of like the same answer for all of them. But I've also done a lot of work where I'm like, I know exactly what where the blind spots are, where I want to move next. And I can imagine for like someone that doesn't spend a lot of time being introspective, like this can get a lot of clarity. Like I can see how someone could get like really clear and have aha moments from this.
Well, it's interesting because if you were to do this exercise, so let me back up. So you could have the same thing in multiple categories. So something could be confusing and missing, or wrong and confusing, or wrong and overwhelming. So that's true. But if you were to do this exercise a year from now, I mean, take your life. If you were to do this exercise now compared to a year from now, you might have very different things on this list.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
You know? And it should, hopefully. I mean, ideally, that would be the way that it is. And one of the other indicators that we have, there's actually two other major indicators on that are part of this exercise. Number one is, what is today's status? So a red is, it's urgent and it's got to change. I always think of blood, right? It's got to change. It's critical. It's something that has to be done now. So we'll mark each one of those things on all five of those columns. We'll give it a red. Or a yellow is, it's okay. Or a green, which is, it's great. And so I'll have them go through each one of those things. Everything that they mentioned will get either a red, green, or yellow. And then this is where the magic happens, is we put a check mark in one of three columns, which is a controllability option that they have. So do they have no control, partial control, or full control of each of those things? And the aha moment comes when they realize that they have far more control than they ever thought they did. Because, and the reason why it's so important is because if you don't think or believe that you have control over something, you will view yourself as a victim. And if you are a victim, look at this, if you're a victim and you feel that long enough, you will get discouraged. And if you believe that and think about that too long, you will become depressed. And if you do that too long, you will get, I mean, really suicidal. Because what ends up happening is people, when they are in discouragement or depression long enough, they just stop feeling things. And, you know, because you're giving up hope, because you don't think that you can change anything. But when you feel empowered, as if you have a lot of volition, which you do, you can do something about most of those things that are on that list. So most of them are either partial or full control. And I think when people see that, they kind of go, wait a minute, I think I've just lost hope in these areas of my life that I can do anything about them. Now, you don't have full, you know, you may not have complete controllability over solving something, but you have full control over your ability to make a difference or improve that area. And that's what I'm really searching for, is not whether you have full control over snapping your fingers and making something different, but what is your ability to actually make change come about in this area of your life? What, you know, let's say, even though you might have partial control over something, but there's something that you can do. And so what is it that you can do to improve that area of your life? So it's really tremendous and empowering people that they do have more control than they believe that they do.
Yeah, I think that's so important. I think you nailed it. There's always something we can do, and there's some tool that we have available, right? And sometimes it takes a third person objective party to kind of pull us out of our own like despair, because sometimes people can be like so close to things, right? Mm-hmm. Or they've been in it for so long that having someone else be like, well, what are some steps that you can take in this mm-hmm. other direction, right? Uh-huh. And then as you know, it's like as you keep going, more tools become available, right? More paths open up. And yeah, you know, I like to say, like, never underestimate the power of a small step, right? Like from one small step, you might meet someone who could help you, or you might be able to heal something, or some door might open that brings some other new opportunity. So it's, I think, just creating movement for someone can be just so empowering.
Oh, I love that. You know, I was just chatting with somebody at the gym this morning, and I was talking about, do you realize the difference a week can make in your life? Mm-hmm. Like, yes, of course, like things take time to change. And sometimes some of the bigger stuff does take time. But do you realize the difference a week can make? I mean, imagine taking steps like every day for the next week to change something. And then looking back a week from looking forward a week from now, it's like, wow, like look what happened in a week. So much can change in a week. It's just so much if we'll take action on it.
Yeah, it's so true. I love that you said that I had that kind of week myself, where it's like I look back and it's like, oh, there was an idea this week, and then there was, a low moment, and then there was a high moment, and then this opportunity came, and then that opportunity came, and it's like, wow, I'm in like a totally different
Thank
state
you.
than a week ago. Yeah, I love that you called that out.
I call it the difference between directional leadership and positional leadership. So positional is what position have I achieved so that I can make the decisions that I want to make? But it's really not about position. It's actually about progress. And so when you think about direction and progress, you think to yourself, well, wait a minute, if I'm heading in the wrong direction of my life or in my life, I can just get off at the next exit and I can cross over the freeway and get going in the right direction. It's actually quite simple. I'm not saying it's easy, but it's actually quite simple. And when you live your life with that sort of continuous improvement, like as long as I'm making progress, one of my favorite sayings in my business is nothing feels as good as progress. Nothing, not even achievement at times. It's just nothing feels as good as progress. And if you constantly feel like you're making progress, well, that kind of feels like momentum. And how much easier is life when you have momentum in a specific area? It's so much easier. So, yeah, I mean, I study the science of momentum because I do a lot of sports stuff. And yeah, it's somebody makes a play. That's the number one indicator or the number one sort of propositional fact that when something changes in a game or something shifts, it's always because somebody makes a play. And typically it's not the hero. Typically it's not the star. It's someone else from the bench or maybe a role player. But when somebody makes a play, they dive into the crowd or they make this amazing play, something shifts and the momentum shifts. And that's the number one way to change momentum is to make a play.
I like that you said it's not necessarily the star player. So how do we bring that metaphor to an individual? Like if something's shifting and it's not the star player, like what is it in an individual's life?
Yeah, there's so much to say about that, right? Like, there's a great book I'm sure that you've heard called Who Not How. And it's like, well, who do I need to invite to my table that's not presently there that I can sort of tap into their wisdom and knowledge? Like, do not do things on your own. It is such a waste of time. Get a coach, get a mentor, get someone in your life who's been there and done that. Because I like to say it this way, that a lot of life is going uphill. Like, it is like going up the stairs. We're uphill in the wind. It's hard to do, but relationships and connections are the elevators. And when you get in the right room with the right people, it's just such a game changer. So the idea is like, yeah, like who can I invite to my table to be a hero for me? And it might not be who I think. It might be a coach, it might be a mentor, it could be someone that's just you find really valuable in your life. Like, quit trying to figure it out and just ask questions. Because David Meltzer, good friend of mine, David always says, asking questions is a sign of humility. And it's a good thing. So yeah, don't be afraid. Don't try and figure it on your own. Don't be afraid to ask questions. So that's the first thought that comes to my mind is like, yeah, show enough humility to ask lots of questions. And yeah, you never know who the hero could be, but it's almost always a who. It's never a how. It's almost always a who.
I feel like I was like meant to talk to you today because you keep talking about like things that are like so relevant in my life right now. Like the who could you invite to your table? Just it again had a crazy week where it was that moment where there were certain who's that like came and like moved things so farther forward, where like a week ago I felt stuck in certain categories, and all of a sudden it's like all these opportunities are open, and it's because of people that I reached out to. So like I just want to highlight like everything you're saying is so true. And I didn't think about it like that, but like you just put it into words like so perfectly. Yeah, very
Yeah,
cool.
and there's another book that's called Rookie Smarts. It's a wonderful book because what it does is it allows you to recruit people into your world that may not be experts, but somehow they just bring these rookies that let's say they get, the first stringer gets injured and this rookie gets thrown into the mix and they perform so well. And because they bring different things to the table that we never even imagined existed. And all of a sudden, this person brings their rookie mentality, their rookie attitude, their rookie learning, ambition, everything like that. And they just come to the table and they just change things for everybody. So we should never discount the person who, you know, maybe we think that we have to get, you know, the best mentor or the best coach in the world. Well, not necessarily. The rookie can actually make a huge difference in your organization as well.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, I've also heard, especially when it comes to coaching, like there's that advice, right? When people are like, who am I to coach anyone? They have that imposter syndrome. It's like, well, you only have to be a couple steps ahead of the people you're coaching, right? And it kind of makes me think about that, right? Like if someone's just a step or two ahead of you and they've unlocked something or figured something out that you haven't yet, then they're going to be incredibly valuable, right? To help you get to that next step.
Very much so. I love that. That's beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah, very cool. It has been so great to talk to you. I feel like this time has flown by. If you want to take a moment and just let people know how they can work with you, because I'm sure after hearing about all these great tools and you know all the people that you've helped, there's a lot of listeners that are going to want to sign up.
Oh, you're so kind to ask. You know, most of my clients live on Instagram or LinkedIn. And so that's where people can find me. So Gary Chupik on LinkedIn, Gary Chupik, Chupik. And you can find me on LinkedIn there. And then on Instagram, it's Elite Mindset. And I'm the guy with the blue verified dot. There's different accounts named Elite Mindset, but I'm the one with the blue verified dot. And they can find me there and reach out anytime they want.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much. Everyone go check out Gary on Instagram. And if this episode resonated with you, send it to someone you think would resonate with them. Like, comment, share, subscribe. Let's help lift humanity up. Have a great week, everyone. I'll see you next time.